This podcast is brought to you by Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
The J Talk Podcast.
Yes.
Hello and welcome to the J Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell. On this week's episode, Dan Ulowitz, Stuart Woodward and Lionel Piguet join me to round up J1 Match Day 12. The J Talk Podcast starts now. All right then, let's begin our review of a wild and wacky J1 Match Day 12 with Dan Ulowitz. Dan, welcome back to the pod. How are you?
I'm good, Ben. Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm terrific. Thank you very much. All right, then. Yeah, so late last week, you posted a poll on Twitter, Dan, asking your followers which games in the Kanto area you should head to on firstly Friday night and then Saturday afternoon. No one could blame you for choosing, and indeed your followers chose, Kawasaki versus Nagoya over Urawa versus Shonan on the Friday. After all, I mean, that was fourth hosting second in the clear choice for game of the round in most people's eyes. So you did go that option. You headed to Todoroki, but it turns out you missed one of the most farcical moments in J-League history and also the clearest case of karma being a true living thing as Belmare overcame all sorts of obstacles at Saitama Stadium.
Yeah, it was, how do I describe the Kawasaki Nagoya game in light of that? There are really few times that you can go to a J-League game and say that you've seen a historical moment, cup finals and championship games aside. But up at Saitama, they certainly had it, and I think that all of us who went to Kawasaki versus Nagoya expecting just a great offensive display by both sides, we were kind of disappointed because they sort of canceled each other out, and it was a very difficult game for both teams. Both teams' players and managers talked after the game about how they struggled to sort of give each other chances. And then, meanwhile, we're watching on Twitter as things are just melting down up in Saitama, and it was crazy to watch from a distance. But Shonan somehow pulled it off, and I mean, just incredible. And the fact that they came back from 2-0 down to win 3-2 is probably the least remarkable thing that happened there.
Yeah, absolutely remarkable. I mean, I've got notes typed out about the game as things progress. But yeah, as I said to you before we started recording, we were a couple of minutes late because I actually wrote out some extra bullet points because there are just so many things I want to make sure that we cover about this game, which was remarkable for so many reasons. I mean, the first point that is going to really get lost in the mix here whenever this game is discussed in the future is that Reds had their best half hour of the season in the first half hour of this game. They deservedly led 2-0 through two terrific goals from Kazuki Nagasawa and Andrew Nabbitt, who scored his first J1 goal. So, yeah, by the 25th minute when Nabbitt scored, Reds were 2-0 up and seemingly cruising. Shonan looked like they were slightly getting a foothold back in the game. And then, yes, it all kicked off in the 31st minute when Daiki Sugioka, who, of course, has fond memories of Saitama Stadium after scoring the winner in the Levain Cup final last season against Yokohama. Well, he muscled past a defender, Dan, and he shot from inside the D. And the rest is, well, it will live on in infamy. And, well, it's a bit much to say that we should have a goal line technology up and running by this coming weekend, Dan. But if Mitsuru Murai had his way, we probably just about would, I reckon.
Yeah, he came out after the game. I think that to offer context to listeners who aren't familiar with Japan's sort of spotty refereeing history, these sorts of controversial plays normally get swept under the rug a bit. News shows don't really like to discuss them. Commentators don't like to discuss them. They seem to be absent from highlight reels and this and that. So for the league chairman to come out and say, essentially, we fucked up, or I should say the referees fucked up, for the vice chairman to come out in, he was, Hiro Mihara was in Kawasaki, and he said, yeah, it was a goal. For Hajime Moriyasu, the men's national team coach, to be there in Saitama and to say, well, yeah, it was a goal, is unprecedented. And I think that 5-10 years ago, it might have gotten swept under the rug. They might have managed to keep it from emerging in the age of social media, or in the nascent age of social media back then. But what we saw in the 24 or so, or 48 hours following that goal, was just such a visceral response, not just from the fans, not just from the media, but also from current players and from former players who went on social media and made their statements. And that's something that we haven't really seen before, and maybe that is what will push us to reform in the form of technological this and that in the J League in the coming months.
So do you think this this kind of slightly more open stance that the league has is an impact of, don't worry, listeners, we're going to come back and talk about this incident because we haven't covered it in it's all its glory yet. But, yeah, we're kind of going off on a slightly wider tangent here. But that's completely okay, Dan, because that's another point that's on my list of bullet points. Is this DAZN opening things up a little bit more? I mean, as you say, I mean, three years ago, there was no critique of match officials allowed in broadcasts. I mean, it was, as you say, it was simply not done at all. And it was, an accepted rule that the media just lived by because they wanted their access to the J-League. And it was followed carte blanche. And it was frustrating to all of us who are used to, refereeing decisions and umpiring decisions being critiqued in other sports in our home countries, not only football, of course. But so can you kind of link this back in some way towards, DAZN? I mean, this season they've started their, what's it called, the J-League Judge Replay Show, which, as you say, 2 or 3 years ago would have never, ever gotten off the ground on Scupper. So has that played a part, do you think, in a slightly more open attitude to critiquing referees and their decisions?
My understanding from hearing, you know, murmurs and stuff from, mutual friends we have and from colleagues who are close to the broadcasting side is that, the DAZN is obviously a British company owned by Perform Group and who have now rebranded as DAZN Media. I don't remember exactly how that went, but they looked at the product from the non-Japanese perspective and said, well, you do need controversy. You can't shy away from it. That's part of the game. You do need critique of the refereeing decisions. And the J-League is learning, finally, after 25, 26 seasons, that, fans aren't going to shy away from the league if there's a mistake, because I think they would love, and they did love for years, to promote the image that the J-League was simply a league in which everyone did their best and, the Gambaru ethic and that sort of thing. And what they're learning is that you can show the negative side. You can have sort of banter. You can have controversy, and fans will still stick with you. And the J-League Judge Replay Show, which in addition to DAZN airs it first, but it's actually all on YouTube as well. So if you go to the J-League YouTube channel, you can see it. It's a great example because you have Hiro Mihara, you have occasionally the head of the JFA's refereeing department, and various other officials and commentators and this and that, and they're discussing these controversial plays, and they're playing, they're looking at the replay, they're looking at different angles, they're looking at slow motion, and they're having these substantial debates over, was this a yellow card or a red card? Was this offside? Was the referee right or wrong? And that's ultimately good for the game because, yeah, you know, the referee doesn't look like the smartest guy in the room, but you can't learn from your mistakes without understanding your mistakes. So in theory, all of this should be good because there have been efforts to establish these dialogues between the clubs and the referees, between the players and the referees, and between the league and the fans to explain these decisions. But then you have what we had on Friday, which was just a colossal failure on the part of four officials to do the right thing.
Yeah, the only four people in the entire stadium that didn't see the ball cross the line. So I mentioned in the 31st minute, Daiki Sugioka shot from inside the D. The ball hit the inside of Shusaku Nishikawa's left-hand post, spun across the goal line, clearly crossed it and hit the net at least a foot inside the other post, so Nishikawa's right-hand post. But then somehow it hit the net at such an angle that it somehow spun straight out and into Nishikawa's hands. So he flung the ball in disgust up the middle of the pitch. But then when a Reds player started running with it, amazingly, the referee allowed Reds to play on. And they very nearly made it 3-0. Unfortunately for Andrew Nabbitt, he was injured in the ensuing counter-attack when Yota Akimoto rushed out and claimed the ball at his feet. So that was the end of Nabbitt's night, unfortunately. He was subbed after the, 5 or 6 minutes of stoppage with the Shonan players, their coach, Chokui Jay, and obviously all of their bench staff and everybody associated with the club absolutely up in arms. This obviously it raises so many questions as well, Dan, about simply doing the right thing. I mean, there are so many incidences in football history where on replay you can see that a ball's come down off the crossbar and it's crossed the line and it's bounced out and play's been allowed to continue. Obviously, goal line technology, where it's used throughout the world, is designed so that is now a thing of the past. But as we know, we don't have that yet in the J-League. But, I mean, this isn't an instance of the ball coming down off the crossbar and maybe, crossing the line by an inch or by, bouncing on the line and not being a goal. So, I mean, again, this is another thing on my list of bullet points. The honesty of the Reds players. I mean, Nishikawa knows that it's a goal. He's flung it up the pitch in disgust. I mean, there's two or three Reds players who, you know, throw their heads back when they see the balls cross the line, but they play on. And I mean, I don't want to sound holier than thou because, you know, I mean, as I say, this has happened numerous times where players have obviously know that the ball has crossed the line, but if the referee doesn't give it, you know, you play to the whistle, etc., etc. But I mean, they don't come any clearer than this. And as you say, though, there were four people in the stadium that didn't see the ball cross the line, and they're the ones wearing black.
I mean, we've seen the goal. I think there isn't a single J-League fan out there who hasn't seen the goal from every single angle. I think that eventually, you know, someone will take the footage and do some Zapruder-esque analysis and look at where every player was on the pitch and what they saw and what the referees' sight lines were and what they saw. Because I even saw something on Twitter showing that before the game, the referee had lined up all of the water bottles out about a meter away from that right post on Nishikawa's right-hand side. And then during the game, through all of the, you know, the players going up to take water at some point, I think some of the bottles ended up actually inside the goalpost. So I think that what that tweet was sort of implying was, well, what if the referee saw the water bottles and thought that it went out or thought it hit the outside of the post? something like that. We can discuss this ad infinitum. I mean, we can think about it until the end of days. And yeah, Nishikawa knew you could have done something like with Leeds and Aston Villa a few weeks ago.
Yes.
Where I think the ref let play continue even though there was an injury or something, and Leeds scored, and Bielsa was like, you know, he told his players to let Villa take one back. That's something that Raul could have done either after the initial argument or at the beginning, let's say at the beginning of the second half, when I would assume everyone had gotten a nice good look at the incident on replay.
Yeah.
I haven't looked at the comments from Oliveira. I don't know what his thinking was. I mean, yeah, I'm not going to say that he was the bad guy. I'm not going to say that what they should or shouldn't have done. I think that all the players understand that wrongs were committed. I would be very interested to see if the league hands out any disciplinary penalties to the players or to the Reds as a club. I'm not quite sure if any of their fair play regulations cover what happened on Friday. Like, this is sort of uncharted territory as far as the J League is concerned. It's all very weird.
Yeah, that's putting it just about right, I reckon. Very weird indeed. Yeah, as we've said, obviously, well, it goes without saying after an incident like this, there's no goal line technology in J1 and no real break or window in the season when it could be introduced. I mean, you know, it's against the current playing regulations, so they would have to be changed in the first place. But yeah, I mean, even with Japan going off to the Copa America, there is no there's no mid-season break or extended break this season where if you know, they wanted to expedite something and get it rushed in during a 2 or 3 week break in the fixture, then I don't really think that's a possibility, is it, Dan?
Well, it is actually because the JFA announced this evening that the officiating team has been suspended. I think the head referee and the linesman who missed it were they got 2 weeks. And the other assistant referee and the fourth official got 1 week. And it seems I need to double check. I'm not sure if there has been an official league announcement, but essentially they have agreed to put in the additional assistant referees. In other words, the goal line referees.
Oh, right.
From August.
Right.
So it looks like from August, I would assume it'll be after that, after the little break for all of the international friendlies.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that'll be when they come in. So we can look forward to that. And I mean, there'll be arguments over whether it's fair to have that in the middle of the season. But I mean, the league and the JFA are in a rock and a hard place. They really have. No, they have to show that they're taking this seriously, and I think they are taking it seriously because in the past, even in this season and last season, we had several non-goal calls, weird phantom penalties and offsides that weren't and offsides that were but weren't called, and a lot of that you can say, well, it was a bad call and move on, but this was a national shame and a global shame. I mean, this highlight went viral. It's been reported in international media. So the league had to do something, and I think these additional assistant referees are the most they can do. And we'll get some sort of technology next year, and whether that's going to be VAR, to say the least. I don't know if they'll do goal line technology and VAR. That might be sort of two parts of the same program. But for everyone who wanted technology to assist the officiating in the J-League, congratulations, you've won.
Yeah, all right then. Well, that's a breaking news there. Thanks for sharing that news. That the referee Yudai Yamamoto and one of his assistants can have a couple of weeks off. Maybe go and visit Megane Super or one of their other preferred glasses shops in the region wherever they reside. But all right, well, so that's all taken care of up to that point where the teams went into the sheds at halftime and Reds were still 2-0 up. There was some speculation that Shaunan weren't going to come out for the second half, Dan, but they certainly made their presence felt after going back onto the field of play. Just 2 minutes after the restart, the halftime substitute Shunsuke Kikuchi smashed in a brilliant volley to halve Belmare's deficit. Then Kikuchi again levelled things with about 10 minutes to go. Completely opposite sort of goal to his first. He calmly passed the ball into the net after a terrific bit of work down the right from Ryunosuke Noda, another Belmare substitute. And then wild scenes in stoppage time. The planets aligned and everyone associated with Shonan went ballistic after Miki Yamane's shot skimmed off Yuki Abe and zipped over Nishikawa and into the net. Absolutely remarkable, Dan. Enormous heart shown by Belmare. I mean, after their first half hour, Reds, I mean, you know, they'll be absolutely stunned to have lost the game. And, you know, to any Reds supporters listening, I mean, hopefully we're not trying to gang up on you too much. I mean, your players probably could have been a bit more honest after the ghost goal. But, I mean, at the end of the day, we've just got to hold our hands up and celebrate the enormous heart shown by the Shonan players, Dan.
Only in the J-League could this happen. We've seen comebacks from 2-3 goals down. This certainly wasn't the first game winner that we've seen in the J-League, you know, deep in this stoppage time like this. But, I mean, this was special. You watch the players and the coaches and the team staff celebrating. I mean, you would think that Shonan had won the title. amazing. And it's almost a shame that this, the circumstances that led to that goal being so significant are going to overshadow the comeback. Because I don't think that, you know, in 5 years, people won't remember the comeback as much as they remember the non-goal. Maybe I'm wrong. I'd like to be wrong. But at least in the near future, I mean, we'll all talk about the goal, the goal that should have been. But, you know, the spirit that the comeback required is going to get diluted a bit, and it's a shame. I mean, it is what it is, but full credit, the fact that Cho has, he is, if I'm not mistaken, the longest currently serving J-League coach with the same club. I think him and Soribachi are the same number of seasons.
That sounds right to me. I was going to say Soribachi if you didn't say they're about the same, so yeah, I reckon you're probably nail on the head there, yeah.
And I mean, Cho has Shonan is such a, they're a small market club. Even with Rizap's buyout last year, I mean, Rizap are dealing with their own financial difficulties. So I mean, that's another conversation entirely. But for a small club in a region that leaves them overshadowed by Kawasaki and by Yokohama Marinos. They've been relegated twice. They've come back twice. Actually, I think he's earned a promotion with them three times, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that's right, yeah.
And to stick with a manager for so long under those circumstances, it shows the immense faith that they have in him and what he's doing. And there are few managers – I think that if he had told his players, you know, that he supported their that if they wanted to boycott and he supported them, I think we would respect him for that. Just as much as we respect him for going out there with the team that he had and getting it done. He is just he's just a no-drama coach, very passionate about the club and the community, and I maybe he's not sort of overlooked in terms of the best coaches in the J League right now, but yeah, he doesn't get as much recognition as he should, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, in the situation that he has to work under, I mean, yeah, with the you know, obviously, you know, they bring through some good players, and they get bought off by in inverted commas bigger clubs, and you know that's just one of the issues he has to deal with. So yeah, he's an absolute credit to that organisation, Chalkwe J, and yes, all of those players that went out there and did the business for Shawnun are as well absolutely remarkable. And alternate universe, Dan, I wonder if you know we're saying that you know that Reds maybe should have given a goal back to Shawnun. I wonder how things would have ended up, because they wouldn't have played the rest of the game with that fire in their bellies and ultimately and you know ultimately come out and you know against all the odds and you know having to score four goals to win 3-2 to you know to get over the line. So I just wonder how the atmosphere of the game would have changed if Reds had have you know, allowed Shawnun to ultimately score the goal that they were denied. But that's something that we'll never know, of course. But, yeah, so Shawnun, absolutely tremendous performance. And interestingly, they've now won on three straight trips to Saitama. They beat Reds 1-0 away in the league last season. Indeed, they did the double over Urawa in 2018. And, of course, they won by the same scoreline, 1-0 in the Levain Cup final, as I said earlier, with Daiki Sugioka scoring there as well, again, in inverted commas. So, well, where does that leave us after 12 games? Well, Shawnun have actually moved above Reds in the table. They jumped up two spots in the table from 11th to 9th, while the Reds slipped from 9th to 10th. They're level on 17 points. Shawnun, a bit of goal difference, better off. So, yeah, both in mid-table after this game, but, yeah, it's a game that will live long in the memory. All right, well, yeah, we did originally plan to talk about FC Tokyo Sapporo and Kawasaki and Nagoya, Dan. So we'll do those in a slightly shorter order than we did Red Belmare. But, well, pleasingly for us, and you were there, of course, at Ajinomoto Stadium on Saturday, the good times keep on rolling for FC Tokyo. Yet they claimed a 2-0 home win over Sapporo, a fifth straight league clean sheet to equal their club record, a first ever J1 goal for Ryoya Ogawa to open the scoring in the 59th minute, and Takefusa Kubo had so much fun scoring his first J1 goal last weekend. He doubled his fun and made it 2-2 with the second 10 minutes later. 12 unbeaten, the first team in the league to 30 points, and now 6 points clear at the top of the table. The very definition of happy days, I would say.
Isn't it weird to have a Tokyo team that's doing well, like with no caveat, no end but, or no buts, no only, you know, they're just a good team. It's so bizarre to me. I'm sure it's bizarre to you too.
It most definitely is, yeah.
I mean, it was so impressive, and I think that one of the things I think I even wrote it as the lead in my game report for JT, but the biggest problem that Tokyo ran into in the second half of last season was when Kensuke Nagai and Diego Oliveira stopped scoring, who's going to pick up the slack? And they didn't. Tokyo didn't have a player who, you know, they didn't have players who could step up when the aces are sort of having dry streaks and score goals. And here you have, like, one of your young players and your youngest player just stepping up and getting it done. I mean, two fantastic goals. And it was a solid game. Once they scored the first goal, I mean, Sapporo picked things up, and they looked like they could have maybe snuck in an equalizer. I mean, Hayashi got the hero interview, and he was playing on his head for some of it. He made some fantastic saves, but once Kubo scored the second goal, it was just game over. The result was never in question after that, and we're going to miss him, aren't we?
Yeah, it's we've just got to hope that that he gets bought and he gets loaned back for the rest of the season for our sake. But yeah, I mean, as I spoke about with Alex Bishop last week, and I mean, Alex was I'm sure he's hit the nail on the head that yeah, I mean, Kubo will most likely wave us goodbye and wish us good luck, and he'll want to get on with his career, and that will take place almost certainly overseas and pretty much straight away. He'll want to get straight stuck in as much as we would like him to hang around until the end of the season. That's probably not going to float his boat. So, but yeah, I mean, all we can do is sit back and appreciate the impact he's made since becoming a regular in the team at the start of the season. It's important, I think, that you mention Hayashi there, Akihiro Hayashi, the Tokyo goalkeeper, because although it does look a comfortable victory on paper, he did have to be on his game. And indeed, his opposite number in the Sapporo net, Gusung Yung, was also in good form. And there was a period there when we got, 10 minutes into the second half, Dan, where I was wondering if Gu was going to do a Kaminsky and keep Tokyo at bay until properly late on. But as it was, yeah, Ogawa was able to make the breakthrough. But Hayashi did make an important save from Chanatip at 1-0. And then in the last 10 minutes, Consadole did tighten the screw a little with Akito Fukumori curling onto the roof of the net, and then Musashi Suzuki firing wide on the turn. But yeah, ultimately, as I say, Tokyo saw out a fifth straight league clean sheet. And I've been trying to rack my brain as to what's different, Dan, about last season. And you don't really want to overstate the importance of a left back, but I think Ogawa does offer a lot more defensively than Kosuke Ota does. I mean, Ota is definitely a fan favourite with the Tokyo supporters. There's no doubt about that. I mean, he's a flashy player. He's got a wand of a left foot in and around set pieces. His delivery has always been a top draw. I kind of criticised Ogawa early doors because I expected him to be a similar sort of player, and he doesn't quite have the same quality of delivery. But I mean, defensively, you can tell the difference that he makes. I mean, literally 30 seconds after he scored the opening goal, he was sliding back to tackle Musashi Suzuki, who looked like he was clean through on goal. So I mean, that's a small area of the pitch, but Tokyo have upgraded there, and that's made a huge difference. With we know how good Morishige, Jang Hyun Soo, and Sei Muroya are on the opposite flank. So just little improvements. I mean, Nagai is much more effective in my eyes than he was most of last season. I mean, he could have scored twice in the first 25 minutes on Saturday, but as it was, Gu did well to save from him on two occasions. So I guess they're just a couple of areas of the pitch, a couple of positions that Tokyo have improved, but it's made just a world of difference, hasn't it?
I think that Kenta Hasegawa, I mean, he's a good manager. The fact that he came onto a Gombo Osaka side that was just totally lost at sea when they were in the process of getting relegated, and he turned that club around and made them, they were the second J-League team to win the treble.
Yep.
After Kashima did it in, I think, 2000-2001. So he's a good manager. I think that things went sour at Gamba, and that sort of tainted our image of him, fairly or not, or otherwise. He came to Tokyo, and I think he's had a good squad. He had a good squad last year as well. I think the difference is that he's, now that the players are bought into his system and to his methodology, and I think that in a way, not having the pressure of some other clubs in the league and, you know, their sort of the more star players, because Tokyo doesn't really have, I think Kubo is arguably the biggest star they have.
Mm.
Like, I mean, bless him, but Keigo Higashi isn't, like, a star. Kensuke Nagai isn't a star. These aren't, like, they're good role players. And you can do a lot with a team of 11 role players. Like, sometimes more than a team of one or two or three superstars, and the rest are sort of okay players. If everyone's really good at what they do, you don't need someone who's fantastic at what they do. And, think about, when was the last time a squad with players who, I wouldn't say average, but like in terms of name recognition, I don't think there's been a title winning squad as average as Tokyo's in quite a few years.
Yeah, I mean, obviously opinion was split on the Hiroshima teams. I mean, they were fairly effective without being, dominant in terms of star quality. But, yeah, I mean, probably Tokyo along similar lines there. And I guess they're playing a similar style of football as well.
Sure. I mean, I think that what those Hiroshima clubs had going for them was mainly Hisato Sato.
Hmm.
I mean, he was a domestic star. Like, I mean, he obviously never made it internationally, but I don't even think that Tokyo has a player like that. Like, I mean, you've got Morishige, Masato Morishige, who's a very accomplished defender for the national team. I mean, it's a team that I think finally transitioned. If you look at these last couple of years, I don't want to say shedding the dead weight, but sort of it's a squad that has freed itself of the emotional baggage that Tokyo had for so many years between about 2010 or so and 2017. I think that there was amongst the supporters a very deep attachment to especially the 2008 squad, 2008-2009 when they won the cup, to a lesser extent 2011 that won the J2 and then won the Emperor's Cup, 2012 when they went to the ACL. The supporters, especially the active supporters, had a lot of affection for those players. Like Naohiro Ishikawa is the greatest example of that. And I think even after those players stopped being as good as they used to be, they carried so much goodwill that it hindered the club's ability to sort of build beyond them. And I mean, this is a very deep philosophical take on FC Tokyo that I'm not sure you were expecting to get into in such a short podcast. But I think the fact that, like, now that Ishikawa is gone and Tokunaga left and, you know, you've got Hayashi in goal, and it was sort of the post-Gonda era is firmly in place. And, you know, Ota is being phased out. And, I mean, Higashi is sort of amongst the last generation, amongst the last of the generation I'm referring to. And I think that, you know, like him and, like, I guess, Morishige, who was part of sort of the post 2010 generation, or I guess 2010 was his first season. Mm. And so you only have, I think, two or three core players who are left from that squad, and that transition is what the team needed. It's a breath of fresh air, just new players, a new shirt sponsor, and it's for the first time in a very long time a new Tokyo.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, we just, I guess we're waiting for the fall. I mean, it might come this Saturday away at Cerezo Osaka, but so far Tokyo passed pretty much every test that's been put in front of them. 9 wins and 3 draws from 12 games. They remain, of course, the only undefeated team in J1. And as I said, the first team to 30 points, and their lead at the top, as we've already said, was extended to 6 points after second place Nagoya and third place Oita both drew 1-1 in match day 12. So yes, we were expecting to talk at length about the game of the round at Todoroki, but as it stands, Dan, we've covered the other two games in a decent amount of detail. So I'll just let the listeners know that Mateus scored an absolute screamer into the top corner right on half time to give visiting Grampus a 1-0 lead at the break. But then with 20 minutes to go, Leandro Damião / Damian equalised for Frontale when he fired low and hard through the hands of Mitch Langerak at his near post. Certainly not Langerak's finest hour, but Damião / Damian scored for the second straight league game. And that was enough to earn Frontale a point. Now, I did not watch this game in full, Dan. So, at the end of the day, was a 1-1 draw just about a fair result, you felt, going over everything that happened over the course of the 90 minutes?
Yeah, it was fair. I mean, I think that it could have been a 4-3 game. And I think a couple years ago, I covered Kawasaki versus Nagoya, and it ended 3-2 or 4-3, and I think it was a Nagoya win, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not going to look it up, but in any case, it was, you'll either have a result like that or like a really stingy 1-1 draw, and I mean that's what it was. I think both teams came in looking to cancel their opponent's attack and to neutralize it, and they were both successful to the extent that aside from the two goals, we didn't really see too much. I mean, each team only had maybe 2 or 3 good chances. Mitch Langerak talked about that to us after the game. It was a game. Like, I think that the takeaway from being there was that we all wished that we had been in Saitama.
Right, you are. All right, well, yeah, so Frontale have just hosted second-placed Nagoya. Well, in match day 13, they travel to third-placed Oita. So that's another interesting game for the Frontale faithful. Of course, as I mentioned, Oita also played out a 1-1 draw in match day 12. They had to come from behind to earn a point at home against Shimizu, for whom Douglas opened the scoring from the penalty spot about 10 minutes before half-time after he was upended by the Oita keeper, Shun Takagi. We've said all season, Dan, that Oita are up towards the top of the table on merit. Well, they might have had their first really big slice of luck in this season in the 47th minute when the defender, Tomoki Iwata, swept in a cross from deep on the right, and it somehow evaded a ruck of players in front of the goal and the Shimizu keeper and found its way into the net. So a fortunate goal. I mean, Iwata wasn't sure whether he should claim it or not. He wasn't sure if anyone had touched it on the way through. Apparently they hadn't. But yes, that meant that Trinita equalised and ended up with a point that saw them join Nagoya on 24, as we've said, 6 behind Tokyo. Kashima joined Kawasaki on 23 points after their 5-0 win at home against Matsumoto. But we might see if Lionel Pige will want to chat about that in a bit more detail later on in part 3. For now, though, Dan, I will let you go. So much to unpack, obviously, from events last Friday night at Saitama Stadium. And indeed, we wanted to give some more props to our boys as the good times continue to roll for FC Tokyo, which is absolutely tremendous. And obviously, that result at Todoroki couldn't have gone any better for us, with both Nagoya and Frontale only able to take a point apiece. So that worked out terrifically. So, it's happy days. Great to get your thoughts on the podcast again, Dan. And, look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Always a pleasure, Ben. Thank you for having me.
Terrific stuff. All right. My thanks again to Dan Ulowitz. Of course, you can follow Dan on Twitter at iStudioTokyo and find his work, his ever-excellent musings in the Japan Times. All right. I'll be back after a quick hit of music with Stuart Woodward. Okay, at the end of part one with Dan, I mentioned that Kashima Antlers were the big winners in J1 Match Day 12, winning 5-0 at home against Matsumoto. But another team to prosper on the weekend was a Yokohama F. Marinos. They claimed a convincing 4-1 win over Kobe at the Nissan Stadium. And joining us to chat about that game and how the things have been going in recent weeks for F. Marinos is Stuart Woodward. Stuart, welcome back to the podcast. Great to have you back on.
Thanks very much. Yep, nice to be back.
And before we go any further, Stuart, I would like to pay tribute to Sean Galbraith, your comrade, of course, a fellow F. Marinos supporter. He's done a power of work for us over the last year or so, guesting on the podcast numerous times to chat about Ange Postecoglou's first season in charge of your side, but yes, we understand that work commitments and a change of job has meant that Sean is not able to attend as regularly, or perhaps not even at all these days, the F. Marinos games. So he's passed the baton, I guess, back to you, as you were at one stage our F. Marinos correspondent. So thanks again to Sean for all of his work, and look forward to catching up with you on a regular basis, Stuart. And in particular, yes, let's get into this game, because it was a very fruitful Saturday afternoon for your side.
Yeah, it certainly was, and a big change from the previous match in Osaka against Cerezo last week, the previous week. I went down there and with little expectation, because Cerezo seems to be the bogey team, and it was walking out the stadium in head in hands again as usual with the Cerezo.
Indeed. Well, should we let the listeners know that we were considering having you on the podcast last week, but after that performance, you didn't feel up to it, and I didn't blame you at all, because that was it was really flat, wasn't it? And it was coming on the back of two straight wins, where it looked like, as we've discussed numerous times with Sean over the past season, I mean, it looked like F. Marinos were finally going to click into gear and finally go on a winning run. But then, to have it halted in such startling fashion last week, I mean, obviously really did pump the brakes on your season. So then to return home you could have hardly had a more willing team of visitors, I would suggest.
Yeah, indeed. The big difference between this match is, like, the Cerezo match, the whole team just looked sluggish. Like, they really, looked slow, and once they conceded the early goal, then they were pretty much done for after that. And, I looked at some of the matches, and, we tend to lose goals, like, very early on, like, against Osaka, first minute, against Sapporo, fourth minute, second minute against Cerezo. So once you get an early goal in, really have to try hard to turn it round. And likewise, the very last few minutes, a lot of goals go in 88th minute in Osaka, 88th minute Kawasaki, and this time Wellington getting his 90+2 consolation in. So they really seem to be struggling at the beginning and the ends of the matches, but this one came off quite well, I thought, with the first goal, Marcos Junior. Yeah, that was like in the 31st minute, the quick turnaround in the possession, capturing the ball, and then immediately turn around into a counter with a nice pass from Endo right to Marcus Junior's feet for him to score from that position there. Okay, Endo's been really coming along in the last few years. Came from the youth team, selected very early by Monbert, and has been like kind of a regular now for about three seasons. He came on when he was straight out of the youth team, and Marinos now, the whole team is totally changed from like even a year ago, and the only kind of consistency are the youth players that have come up, Kida, Endo, and Amano. Everybody else having changed. So you know, going on to the second goal. Like that, I think that was the first goal for Tadanarri Lee in the league, maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
And So and he came on for Edgar Junior. Edgar Junior was meant to be this year's big goal scorer, the big signing, but he pulled up a couple of matches ago, quite a few matches ago, with a muscle strain, or like I thought he'd done his hamstring initially, and he just signaled to be taken off immediately, and you could see Postecoglou, you know, like putting his head in his hands, you know, there's our forward gone. So Edgar Junior is just coming back, as is Tadanarri Lee for out of injury. So they're not playing full matches now, but so Lee came on for Edgar Junior, and again the goal set up like a totally different one this time, with a kind of a mazy dribble from Endo at the side, and I thought he was going to shoot it in, but the angle was getting very difficult, and just passed to Lee, who was waiting in the right place just to tap it in, and I think that really sealed the match at that point. That was like a 67th minute there. There was quite a lot to catch up, and two more goals after that from Miyoshi. The third goal being a little chip from Territon across the box, straight to Miyoshi's foot and straight in the goal. Like, you know, great skills from both of them there. And with the fourth goal, like Amano shot from the edge, keeper saved it. Miyoshi was just in the right place to put it in. And I think like one of the really big differences this year is the organisation and the concentration. Like with the very first goal, as soon as the possession was taken, everybody was in place and they were running and away to on the counter. Like the positioning is really really good, and this actually might be a little bit of the problem too, because they're having to play with like such concentration in the system that if they're not like coming out of the the tunnel and straight into the match, then it can take a little bit of while to get into it, I think.
Indeed. All right. Well, four excellent goals, a comprehensive victory for F. Marinos. And as you mentioned briefly earlier, Stuart, a consolation for Wellington late on to make it 4-1. I did want to touch on the two Brazilians. You mentioned that Marcos Junior scored the first goal. He'd done a pretty impressive job filling the breach while Edgar Junior was out, hadn't he? I mean, Edgar Junior was injured in the sixth round, and it was just coming back to make his first start back after recovering from injury, because he'd come off the bench in the previous game. So, Marcos Junior has really filled the breach, and now it's Edgar Junior's chance to really pick up the reins, I think, because he had looked impressive in spells in the first month or so, and Ange Postecoglou will hope that he's properly fit and ready to really make an impact.
Yes, we've been very impressed with him, and he seems to be such a kind of a positive influence on the team. Like in direct comparison to our former Brazilian Kaique, who just brought the team down. He just seemed to have such a negative and selfish style. But Marcos Junior, he's like crazy. He can tell that he really wanted to come to Japan. He's like an anime fan. He's modeling all his goal performances on these anime characters. So you can see the Japanese teammates are just like kind of laughing with him because he's just so over the top in everything he does, like his expressions and the enthusiasm. So it's like one of those players that kind of really lifts the spirit, and I think that's been very good for the team too. And also I'm kind of interested in the behind the scenes of, you know, what's going on. And when Tadanori Lee came on to the player introduction in the very first, when the players are introduced to the fans in the before the preseason, he seemed to be obviously very mature and very kind of a strong character too. So he's probably the oldest one in the dressing room now. So with Bomber not there and Kurihara playing a minor position now. So the whole team seems to be on the same track, and that's very much a part of the Postecoglou style. You're either with him or you're out, really. You know, he's looking for everybody to play his way. And one of the comments this week was why wasn't Amano and Miyoshi starting members? Well, Postecoglou was asked about that in one of his interviews, and he said nobody has a guaranteed place in the team, and he chooses the team for each week based on who's doing well and who will fit what he wants to do. And this week, it was really good for them to come on later in the match when they were fresh. And because we saw Miyoshi, scored two goals, Amano set up one goal. It really can't complain about the way things are going, except for the occasional kind of a blip where instead of scoring three, we'll let in three. Like with Sapporo and Oita, being two examples. Sapporo, Oita, and Cereza, being two examples. It's either a good win or a good thrashing in a way.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's been such a stop-start season, but it's been such a stop-start, 15 months, really, because that was one of the hallmarks of 2018, wasn't it, as well? You flashed so much potential on so many occasions, but you weren't able to really make it stick, and you're just as likely to score four at one end, but let in four or five at the other with, of course, Hiroki Ikura and performing all of his magic tricks. But this season, for the most part this season, he's been cast aside, and the Korean keeper Park Il-gyu has come in. And so how much of a difference has that made to the stability of the team, Stuart? I mean, is he still playing in a similar vein to Ikura, but just makes you feel a bit more comfortable about the way he goes about things? Or has Postecoglou changed fundamentally the way he wants his defence and keeper to play?
Well, that's a very good point, because when Park came, was signed, it wasn't really on many people's radar, but he was Ryukyu's number one keeper for the last couple of years, but made way for, I believe, a Costa Rican keeper that was brought in. But and he plays in a very, very similar style to Ikura, in the same way, running out of the box and playing high, which is Postecoglou's style, but still also dribbling in front of the opposition forwards and doing a side pass to the defender on the left or on the right. It's that whole style of playing from the back, and quite dangerous at times. But I haven't seen that to be a problem. It's more the early goal, being the one that lets us down. But We haven't had so many of the comedy incidents that we had, especially last year, where people were, punting from a very great distance into the goal, which was part of the Postecoglou plan. He said, his theory was that you know, 9 out of 10 times you're going to miss, but it seemed to be the ratio seemed to be a lot worse than his expectations. But still, you know, Park actually has got very good reactions. You know, like having seen a player play in a certain position for such a long time, you kind of think that they're good because you know it's their own. You have no comparison really, but. After a match or two, you know, quite happy with Park, and because his just reactions are very, very good. Like if you look at the stats for the last match, I think Kobe had almost as many shots on goal as Marinos did, but they were very like good saves, like instant saves. You know, quite forward. You know, in the front of the box where his instant reaction just actually, you know, saved the day. So Marinos had 15 shots, Kobe 13. Marinos had 5 shots on target, and Kobe had 6 shots on target. So it was he saved the day in that case. The other kind of interesting thing is that. We seem to pick up a lot of players. Like if you look at the players that Marinos signs, you can't really understand why they sign a lot of these players. Where are they you know getting the kind of the information or the scouting to pick up these players? But one thing I've noticed is that a lot of the players are coming back to this area. You know, the Kanagawa. Like we got 2 from Ryukyu in a Park and. Another Nakagawa and also Wada Tatsuya from Hiroshima who's also like into the first team even though he was signed very very late on, so we're kind of bringing back all these local players who want to come back like they're to I guess a team in this area. And I know that Park's mother is still a Ryukyu fan.
Right.
I actually met her with some of the other Marinos fans who also go to the Ryukyu fans. Met her outside Ajinomoto, and we came all the way back on the train, which is a very long way from Ajinomoto to Nissan Stadium. Quite a few changes. It was a kind of an interesting thing to be coming with the goalie's mum.
Right, indeed, yeah. Well, yeah, so Park, he made his J1 debut for RF Marinos in match day 5, the home draw against Tosu, and he's been ever present ever since. So we might just have seen the last of Hiroki Ikura in J1 games for RF Marinos, of course, injury permitting for Park. We'll wait and see. Obviously, how the rest of the season pans out. But, as we've said on numerous occasions, a convincing win for RF Marinos on Saturday, Stuart. So, what of your visitors then? Alan Gibson spoke passionately about the state of Vissel Kobe on last week's episode of J-Talk. So, it's interesting for me, and I'm sure for the listeners as well, to get another perspective, another set of eyes, if you like, on Kobe. You mentioned the shot count, and I mean, it sounds like Kobe were decent value in terms of attempts, in terms of troubling the opposing goalkeeper a bit more. They couldn't do any less last week when they only had 1 shot over the course of 90 minutes at home against Kashima, so they simply had to be better here. It sounds like they were, but at the end of the day, yes, they were. All they were able to take away from the game was that 92nd-minute consolation for Wellington. So what did you make of them on the afternoon? As I say, a fresh pair of eyes on what is basically the last few weeks been an absolute clown show.
Well, you know, as Alan mentioned, like they weren't so bad. But, like, you know, I look at, you know, obviously, you know, my eyes are more focused on the Mariners side. And we were having many kind of errors, like losing, you know, like balls getting caught, you know, passed in the wrong place, you know, players losing the ball, you know, that's like a high ball and just the you know, not knowing where the ball is. So we were making lots of mistakes. But I think with the possession, like the possession, like again, Marinos like 63-37 on this one. That's the style. I don't know whether Kobe just say, okay, let them have the possession and we'll catch them off guard. But I could see, you know, like David Villa's like a frustration growing, and especially towards the end of the match, he was getting really kind of annoyed, I think, by the whole situation. And also, as you know, everybody on Twitter and DAZN has seen, you know, like everybody's feeling sorry for Iniesta. I wonder if it's in his contract that he has to appear in every match. So even if he doesn't play, they have to have a camera on him watching the match to see his reactions. And he was obviously, you know, not enjoying the match at all there, which I'm sure it doesn't make him feel any better seeing that in the kind of press afterwards, if he actually looks at any of his comments. But yes, I also felt that the Kobe manager is kind of in such a tough position, because obviously he's got the money behind him, he's got the probably the pressure with to perform, but unless you have a strong system and everybody's playing to that system, then you're not going to play very well, unless even if you have the best players in the world on there or on the bench. So I was kind of obviously hoping for a win to on the match day, but I wasn't expecting such a big win as that, and kind of I guess I'm not really fair to say that, you know, like Kobe were a bad team, but you know, they couldn't pull it off in the end.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, I have a sneaking suspicion that Lionel might want to say a few words about Kobe in part three as well. So we'll leave Vissel there, Stuart. And I guess that's where we'll leave proceedings from the Nissan Stadium on Saturday. Great to see Yokohama get back to winning ways, as we say, after that really disappointing result against Cerezo the previous weekend. It's Iwata at home this coming weekend before a Kanagawa derby away at Shonan on Friday night in match day 14. So that should be an interesting occasion.
Yep, I'll be at both of those matches. We seem to be quite visible as on Twitter and places like that. Almost every week, somebody's contacting me and wanting to come along to the match with us. Some people come along for one match. We have visitors like from overseas come, and we take care of them. Our group is like a mixed group, Japanese and like a foreign people there, very friendly. So if anybody ever wants to come and watch with us, and sometimes we do get members of the podcast here who sneak in and watch with us. But everybody's welcome to come and experience our group spirit, even if you're not a Marinos fan or just a casual fan. We'll save a seat for you if we know.
Well, that's terrific. So what's the best way for people to get in touch with you, Stuart, if that piques their interest?
Yeah, well, I think the easiest way is Stuart CW on Twitter. Most places I'm that also online. Yeah, I'm Stuart CW. So yeah, but people seem to have no problem finding us. Like, from, you know, like I saw some post years ago and contacted you, thinking I might come to the match. Is quite a common introduction.
Superb. Oh, well, you guys have set the standard in the past, you know, five or seven years for, engaging foreign supporters. Absolutely remarkable stuff. And you deserve so much credit for being so inclusive and, for being such passionate supporters. Absolutely tremendous stuff. You'd actually mentioned ever so briefly talking about Iniesta. You mentioned DAZN there. Stuart, and you mentioned, well, we both know how passionate you are about Yokohama F. Marinos. I haven't seen too much from Kosuke Nakamachi on DAZN. Apparently, DAZN's coverage doesn't extend to Zambia, but do you know how he's getting on at ZESCO United, and have you planned a trip over to catch up with your old mate Kosuke?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I actually, a couple of weeks ago, like in the break, the core leader went over to Zambia to see him, and it took him quite a long, quite a few flights to actually get there, and he actually managed to meet him, and like part of it is to take footballs, because they started off this whole kind of relationship with Africa by taking footballs over to the kids there, and just giving them to kids to play in the street with their footballs. I don't think I'm going to make it to Gambia, and I wonder how long Nakamachi will get there, because he's separated from his family by being there, and I'm not sure he's actually playing so many in the first team. I've seen that he has played, but his Instagram is always pictures of interesting things that have come up, like the hotel accommodation with the mattress on the floor, and other unique African cultural experiences that I guess he's going through there. But all credit to him, because he had definitely career ahead of him in Japan. I'm sure he could have played for a couple more years, even like in another J1 or in J2, but bowed out very gracefully from Marinos, and seems to be having an interesting time at least.
Yes, terrific stuff. And come on, DAZN, buck up your ideas. I want to get some Zambian Premier League games watched. So let's see if that eventuates in the coming months. All right, sure, Lee, absolutely terrific to have you back on the podcast.
No problem.
Thank you very much. And, good luck against Iwata this coming weekend. And, look forward to catching up with you again throughout the season.
Yeah, thanks very much.
All right, my thanks again to Stuart Woodward. I'll be back after another quick hit of music with Lionel Piguet. All right, welcome back to part three, and it's my pleasure to welcome back for his first appearance of 2019, Lionel Piguet. Welcome back to the podcast. How are you?
Yes, thank you. I'm fine, thank you. Very fine indeed. Much better after this weekend.
Well, yes, as regular listeners to the podcast know, you have a foot in the Gumba Osaka camp, Lionel, and they upset the form book on Saturday night at the Panasonic Stadium at Suita. As we all know, the form book goes out the window in a derby, etc., etc., and it certainly did on Saturday night. Gumba came into the game without a win in seven straight games, while Cerezo were three unbeaten heading in, and they'd come off a comprehensive 3-0 home win over Yokohama F. Marinos. Well, yes, the form book was well and truly torn up, Lionel, as Gumba triumphed 1-0 thanks to Shu Kurata's goal.
Yeah, exactly. And once again, Cerezo brought Gumba back to life. That's the second year in a row that they do that. And it's amazing. Like, they've been cursed. They're really cursed. They lost their two games against us last season, and once again, this season it starts pretty bad for them against Gumba, and it's a bit of a surprise, because to be honest, like before the game, I was even thinking about should I go or should I not go, because I was a bit upset after Gumba lost against Sagan Tosu, and when I saw what Miyamoto, the team that he filled in, at first I was wondering, like, he's either a genius or he is totally mad and he lost it. But no, he's really, he did something superb, because those youngsters, they are truly, truly amazing. They're really good. And Gumba have a very good youth system, and they are good. They play their games, and they were really, really, really good.
Yeah, well, so for the second straight week, I have to hold my hands up and say I have heard nothing of an impressive young Gumba player. Last week it was Ryotaro Meshino, who of course scored a spectacular goal away at Tosu. And this week it's Leo Takae, Lionel, who I don't know head nor tail of, but he set up Kurata for the winner. And yeah, it sounds like he's just the next cab off this production line of exciting young footballers that Gumba are bringing through.
Gumba have some really, really good promising players. They have like the Ko, the half Chinese, half Japanese player who left Gumba now. He's with the national team. And then Nakamura, of course, who is like only 17, or I think 18 maybe, who is very promising. Meshino, Takao, and Takae, all those players are really promising, and they've been doing very well with the U23, the reserve team that plays in the J3. And I've been following those kids for quite a while now, and the Gumba is really pushing for those kids to play more and more. They do not allow any overage players to join the U23. Only the goalkeeper this weekend was over 23, but most of the players are like well under 23 years old, and it's been like that at Gumbas for many years now. Started from like Antonetti, when who is the head coach of Metz in France. When he joined Gumba in like, 1999, already he told us that the Gumba's priority was to bring in young players, and that's exactly what they've been doing for years. And yeah, they play a role, because actually some of the players that they replaced this weekend were players that lost too many games with Gumba, that were not performing well. I mean, OJ Sock, the number 22, right back. He's a player I really loved in the past, but now he's getting slower. He's not very good when going forward. Or Fujiharu, who is okay going forward, but terrible when it comes to defending. Those players are, even Endo or Kono, I mean, I loved all those players in the past, but maybe it's time to bring in like some new young players, and that's exactly what they did. And well done to them, really, really well done to them. And on the other side, Cerezo, well, I'm not too sure what's happening with that team, because they just can't score. They scored only 10 goals this season, and they are not, I don't know how to explain, but They are not fancy to watch. They are not beautiful to watch. They are passing the ball around. Reminds me a little bit of Vissel Kobe, and just passing the ball. And when it comes to the last third of the pitch, they are not dangerous anymore, and they lose it all. And I mean, I like the coach, and I think he's been doing a kind of like an okay good job, but yeah, I don't know what happened against Gumba. I don't know. They were very inoffensive, and they only started like being dangerous in the last 10 minutes of the game.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you how the game went, Lino, because I mean, on paper it looks a pretty even contest. I mean, 10 shots apiece according to the official J League stats. Obviously, just the one goal of Karata's effort 10 minutes into the second half, and we know the quality that Cerezo has on paper, and they've obviously really struggled to make that count on the pitch. It looked like they were starting to get a decent run of form going with that three game unbeaten run, as I mentioned, a draw against Oita and then wins over Matsumoto and Yokohama. But well, I think you've already just about answered my next question. They never really got going until the last 10 minutes, when I guess the gravity of the situation really hit them. Hang on, we better try and really work our pants off for an equaliser here.
Well, the game started, I thought the game started very well for both teams, because both teams played entertaining football. It was going from one end of the pitch to the other, and I thought the game was pretty interesting, pretty intense. Not too much aggressivity. Of course, there were some fouls because that's a derby, and you don't want to lose it, and you really want to please your fans in a totally packed stadium. I think the atmosphere was great, really really great from both ends. But then, I don't know. Just that last pass that maybe you know how we used to. Well, I don't know about you, but like how a lot of people used to complain about the Japanese national team in the past, like let's say 10, 15 years ago, it was all about passing the ball around the goals, but never taking like the risk to shoot.
Yeah.
And that's how it was for Cerezo for most of the game, like creating spaces, going forward, but then instead of trying to get like some space to shoot, no, just pass the ball to the guy who is next to you, which I thought was a little bit, they really should take more chances, and they clearly didn't do enough against Gamba. And it's all good for Gamba because with a much younger team, with some players that were Fukuda, who is a great kid, he played his first 90 minutes of J1 football this season. He played last year. He was in the very first match. He was like a starting 11 in the very first match against Nagoya Grampus under Kulpi. So Kulpi brought that boy. And he's very promising. He's unbelievable. He has the skill. He has everything. But I didn't know why he wasn't in the first team this year until Saturday. And yeah, I guess we will see much more of him, of this boy, because he created so much. He was maybe physically like light when defending, but when going forward, fantastic, fantastic boy. Really, really did a lot. So yeah, it's like it's interesting. I'm looking forward to see what Gamba will do next. See if they will keep those young players, if they will keep faith in them, or if they will bring back the like Osiesok or Fujihara. Let's see, and hopefully for Gamba fans, hopefully we'll see more of those young players.
Indeed, and as you say, in midfield, really interesting to see both Konno and Endo start on the bench. They both came on, of course, to steady the ship towards the end of the game, and Gamba hanging on, as we said, 7 without a win coming in, so it goes without saying, a much needed victory. And as Lionel has said, yes, it is the perfect opponent at the perfect time for Gamba. So what are the chances that this is the beginning of a turnaround for Gamba then, Lionel? How much confidence do you have in this team going forward? I mean, you said you all almost didn't turn up after the previous weekend's dismal display away at Tosu, but now you've obviously rediscovered your love for the club after a derby win. But now you have to head up to Sapporo to play your Consadole this coming Saturday before your host Kashima. So they are two very testing looking fixtures, I would say. Is this sort of result a springboard for more positive results in the next couple of weeks, do you think?
Well, the thing is, like, the team before the game against Cerezo, or actually during the last 10 minutes of the game, the team really looked sick, and they were scared of the ball, which means that whenever a player had the ball, it really seems like the ball was, like, you know, burning his feet. And he wanted to get rid of the ball as quick as possible, and that's exactly what Gamba did for like 6-7 games in a row, and that's exactly what happened against Tosu. Players' lack of confidence didn't feel, I don't know, even though they are enjoying life under Miyamoto, they really lacked confidence, and they lost their football. And now it came back against Cerezo, but we could see during the last 10 minutes they were panicking. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to control the game anymore. And they were kind of losing it. They wanted to go forward to score another goal, but at the same time, they were too scared. So actually, they just like stay back, and that could have been costly. So we'll see. Hopefully, this win will help the players get over the bad result and just start the season as you know, just like they finished last year. But you know, who knows? Like, if they go to Sapporo, lose against Sapporo, and then they will get Kashima. Yeah, it's hard. It's really, really hard to predict. Really, really hard.
Indeed. Well, as it is, though, a first home win in the league in 2019. So that's a monkey off Gumba's back. Of course, they won their first two away games of the season. But then, yes, that long winless run, that was finally snapped. And, yes, we'll see if it's a springboard for a decent push up the table as the Gumba move two spots up to 14th. In the table, with that victory, Cerezo dropped a spot to 11th, coincidentally. But Lionel Gumba rose above Vissel Kobe in the table after the weekend's results. And a little birdie tells me that you wouldn't mind sharing your thoughts on Vissel. By all accounts, an improved performance away at Yokohama, but it couldn't have been much worse than the one the previous week against Antlers. Stuart Woodward gave us the stats and said that they were better than obviously in the previous game, but as I say, they simply had to be. But the state of that club, it's just a project that just seems to have completely run off the rails.
Well, the thing is that the day they brought in Podolski, I thought the club was not going the right way, toward the right direction. Podolski, I heard like from like a friend of mine who is a football agent. He told me before he moved to Japan, he told me that player is just can't play anymore. He's tired. He can't run, and he just can't play. And that's why his Turkish team didn't want to keep him. And he came here, and it's exactly what happened. I mean, his first game was good. He scored two goals. He was good. But then the club went from bad to worse, and they brought in, like, some players that, I mean, Iniesta, he's a wonderful player. He still got it, and he still can play at high level. But like Villa is too old. That guy was already too old when he was playing in America. I mean, he can't run. He's always offside. He can't run anymore. He doesn't have the pace anymore. And they bring him in like a very fast league. I mean, the J League is kind of like the pace is pretty high, pretty fast. Players are technical. They have the speed. They have everything. Like, how can this guy make a difference going forward? He doesn't have the speed anymore. It reminds me of Diego Forlán when he joined Cerezo Osaka. Diego Forlán came to Cerezo Osaka thinking like he could come and play here, just take his time and just like kind of like retire just before retirement. And what happened is that it brought the whole team down, and Cerezo from finishing top three. And they went to the Asian Champions League. They ended up being relegated, and that's exactly what I thought that was going to happen to Vissel Kobe. They're bringing in Villa, who is far too old, paying him a lot of money, much more than those Japanese players. They're bringing in like Iniesta, who gets like 25 million a year, like far, far, far more than the entire team. I mean, what do you expect your Japanese player? You know, how will they feel about it? Why is this guy getting like 100 times more than I'm getting, and he's not even making the difference? So that's what's happening. And then they brought in Dunkler, who played in Ligue 2, in the second division in France for RC Lens. and he was part of Arsenal's worst team ever in their history. They nearly got relegated to third division on that year, and he only stayed 6 months, and he got kicked out after 6 months because he was that bad. And they brought him in. I don't understand. And he's not that bad. He's not such a bad player for Vissel, but he's definitely not good enough either. And he's like playing instead of those Japanese players who are better, to my point of view. So it's like, I don't know what's happening at that club. I really don't understand, because when I moved to Japan, that was 2003, they were still playing with their white and black shirts, just like the Juventus. And I really liked those colors. And then Rakuten came in, Mikitani came in. He came, changed the logo, changed the color, changed everything at the club, which I think is a no-go for us in Europe. It's something you can't do. You don't touch the team colors. You don't touch the team crest. You don't touch those things. Or if you change it gradually. Don't change everything at once. Otherwise, the fans won't be behind you anymore. The fans won't be, the people won't be satisfied anymore. So, yeah, I'm a little bit sad because I kind of like this club. I don't hate them. I kind of like them. I have many friends who are Vissel Kobe fans. I live in Kobe. So I want to see the club doing better than that. But to be honest, they don't deserve to do better than that.
Yeah, they're definitely a tough team to love at this point in time, aren't they, Lionel? Seven straight losses has seen them plummet down the table from fourth to 15th. And, yeah, there doesn't appear to be much hope for them in the coming weeks. But, well, there you go. I mean, Gumba have just won a very important game to them after having not won in seven games. It wasn't seven straight losses, but along a similar vein, although they haven't looked as hopeless, it must be said, as Kobe have at many junctures in their horrible run. All right, well, Lionel, stick with us here, because there's three games that we're yet to cover. So if you don't mind, we'll run through
of course
those together. Thank you very much. All right, so the first of those I did mention at the end of part one with Dan, and indeed at the start of part two with Stuart. That's the biggest winners of the match day, Kashima. They smashed Matsumoto 5-0 at home. Leo Silva got them going in the 25th minute, then set up birthday boy Ryohei Shirasaki for the first of his brace 2 minutes into the second half. Serginho made it 3-0. Shirasaki added the fourth before Atsutaka Nakamura added the final gloss 7 minutes from time. That's a three straight wins now for Antlers, Lionel, and a four without a win in contrast for Yamaga, who are the second lowest scorers in the division, having netted just six times in 12 games. That's a very Tosu-esque of them. But yeah, Kashima, three straight wins now, and they've drawn level with Kawasaki on 23 points. Starting to look rather ominous, I would say.
Yeah, they look good. They look good and they look impressive. They look strong, and they started the season pretty slowly. But then you could see that the players were getting fit, were getting into the pace of the games. And they are beautiful to watch. I really enjoy watching them there. And yeah, I want to see how much farther they can go. I think they'll be fighting for the title until the very end. And I they are for me my favorites to win the title this season. I think Tokyo have been good too. They've been impressive. They haven't lost a game, but be careful of Kashima, because they will come back strong. Very strong.
Yeah, well, they're just one of the teams I'm looking over my shoulder at the moment, Lionel. Obviously, Kawasaki scared the living daylights out of me. But yes, Kashima come with a massive reputation that is fully deserved, of course. So yes, they sure to be in the reckoning as well. I mean, there's no guarantees that Tokyo will be in the reckoning. They're just as likely to fall off a cliff as they did in the second half of last season. So yeah, certainly not counting any chickens that the Gasmen will be hanging around in the title race. But yeah, enjoying a life at the top while it lasts. Hiroshima certainly can't say that anymore. Lionel, they lost for the fifth straight game. There was a plenty happening last Friday night, of course, with all the drama at the Saitama Stadium, and their 1-0 home loss to lowly Tosu might have escaped the attention of some, but Tosu rose from the foot of the table, actually, with their second straight win. It did come in extremely fortunate circumstances, it must be said, with just 3 minutes left and the game seemingly headed for a 0-0 draw. Tosu player Hiromu Mitsumaru crossed from the left, and the Hiroshima substitute Emil Salomonsen leapt to attempt to clear it, but all he did was head the ball up and over his keeper and into the net. So an unfortunate own goal there from Salomonsen, but Tosu won't care a jot about that. That's a two straight wins for them after they looked, it's very early to call any team dead and buried, but they looked completely rudderless and completely hopeless, Lionel. But now it's a two straight wins, and Shimizu have replaced them on the foot of the table. But, I don't know, you obviously saw Tosu firsthand last week when they stunned Gumba. This is another obviously positive result for them, although it did come in very fortunate circumstances.
It's very surprising. I still don't understand how Gumba and Hiroshima managed to lose against Tosu, because I don't really like the way Tosu is playing football. It's not beautiful at all. They are not playing beautiful football, like really not. And how did they manage? Like Hiroshima, they just didn't play. They just didn't play that game. I don't know what happened to them. Why all of a sudden, from like being a good team, they are not playing attractive football, but still they are consistent and they are strong at the back. From being like a strong team at the back, going forward and scoring goals, not too many, but still they are scoring. From doing that to, losing five in a row is kind of a surprise to me. It's surprising. But what surprised me the most is really Sangan Tosu. Like, how did they manage to win those two games? I don't know. I can't explain it. Really, really. Against Hiroshima, the game wasn't exciting at all. And yeah, that goal just shows it's the highlight of the game, really.
Yes, indeed. All right, so that's Hiroshima covered. That means we've covered all four of the ACL clubs, Lionel. So just ever so briefly, the final match day of the group stage is coming up this midweek in the ACL. And, somewhat remarkably, after their performance in group stage match day one, as we've said previously on the pod, Sanfrecce are the only Japanese club who have already qualified for the round of 16. So you can be certain that they will take a B, possibly even a C team down to Australia to face eliminated Melbourne Victory. That will be Keisuke Honda's final game for the Australian club, we believe, before he waves goodbye to them. And Sanfrecce likely to finish group winners, I think, but if they suffer defeat and the other group result goes against them in terms of, I was going to come on to say that I don't know all of the permutations off the top of my head in regards to Takashima, Kawasaki and Urawa, but they could all do with winning in their final group stage game, and that will probably be enough in all three cases to take them through. But again, I don't know all the permutations, so don't sue me. On Tuesday night, Kawasaki are away also in Australia to face Sydney FC, the new A-League champions. They defeated Perth Glory on penalties over the weekend. Also on Tuesday night, Urawa are hosting Beijing Guoan of China, while, as we've said, on Wednesday night, Sanfrecce are in Australia to play Melbourne Victory, and Kashima host Shandong Luneng of China. And I think it's Antlers who might be relying on help from elsewhere, as a win for them might not be enough to take them through. But again, as I say, I don't know all the permutations off the top of my head. But Lionel, that leaves us with just one game to go then. And it was Iwata beating Sendai at home 2-0. Dialton scoring in the 19th minute after an assist from Masato Nakayama, and it must be said, some pretty horrendous defending from Vigalta, dealing with a long punt forward from Kaminsky. Well, Nakayama set up the first, and then he scored the second. Terrific strike for his first J1 goal. These two, I guess, we expect to struggle down towards the foot of the table for most of the season. But, yeah, well, Iwata, that's now two wins in three, and the game in between, Lionel, was that loss at the leaders FC Tokyo last week. So they're not travelling too bad, I suppose.
It's strange because I really didn't see Vigalta struggling that much this season, because just like Shimizu, I mean, those two teams have been playing very attractive and offensive football last season, and they were. I really, and every time I went to see them, every time I watched their games, I enjoyed it very, very much. And they were, for me, the atmosphere in the team, the football they were playing was always good. And yeah, this season they just can't. Like Vegalta, they just can't. They have a German in front, half American, who is a good lad. I think he's a good player, but he isn't making the difference yet. And I don't know, I feel a bit, I kind of like Vegalta Sendai, and that I don't like to see them dropping too many points. But yeah, they're going to have a very, 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 very long season. And Iwata too, last season they weren't playing so good, and this season they are struggling again. And can they survive this season? Well, they took the 3 points this weekend, and they it's well to them. It's good, it's true that they travel better than when they play home. Just like Gomba, actually, those two teams just can't win games at home. But then, good to them. They won. They deserve the win. Let's see how far they can go. Let's see if they can survive. Let's see if they can keep winning. If they can keep winning away games, why not? Can they hold on until the end of the season? It's gonna be interesting, really interesting. The fight at the bottom will be as exciting as the fight at the top of the table. Really, really, it's gonna be very interesting to see what Gamba, Vissel, Shimizu, Iwata, Sagantosu, all those teams. Vegalta. It's gonna be very interesting to see who's gonna get the best, who's gonna wake up, who's gonna get the points. During the few coming weeks, it's going to be interesting, really.
Most definitely, and yeah, that's the bottom seven are just separated by just 3 points after 12 games. So that's right. I mean, the two Shizuoka clubs are the bookends there. Iwata 12th on 12 points, and Shimizu currently bottom on 9. But yes, as we know, things can change very quickly in the J League, especially in J2, of course, but yes, in J1 as well. And what a match day 12 it was. So it's been absolutely brilliant to catch up with you again, Lionel. For everybody listening out there, if you're not already, please give Lionel a follow on Twitter at Lionel Pigay. Of course, always put the Twitter handles of my guests in the episode description. But Lionel, as I say, fantastic to have you back on the podcast for the first time this year, and I very much look forward to catching up with you throughout the season.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
All right, then. That is it for the J-Talk podcast for another week. Another long one, but thanks to our supporters on Patreon, we don't need to worry about that anymore, do we? And if you are a Patreon subscriber, a donator, contributor, I'm still not sure of the terminology there, but if you support us on a Patreon, yeah, keep an eye on your inbox, because I'm going to be sending you everyone who's a contributor there a message in the coming days for your opinion about something that is coming up soon, and that is a very exciting announcement for JTalk. But for now, we will leave it there for this week. So my thanks again to Dan Orlowitz, Stuart Woodward, and Lionel Pigay, and of course to you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up another busy weekend in the J-League. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast.